Good morning, everyone. Welcome to NSPS Radio Hour for another edition this Monday morning. I want to welcome Chris Klein to the show again. Welcome, Chris.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here again.
I know our listeners over time have heard Chris on the show a number of times, and we're always interested in what's going on with him and new things that he's doing. And it seems to me, Chris, you're always working on something that you never get to the point where you feel as though you've completed all your work and then you can just share that with everybody. You're always working on new stuff.
I try. It's nice to have new material, and quite frankly, as I travel around the country, people are saying we're tired of the same old, and would like something new. And it's, you know, there's a lot of new material out there, not just mine, quite frankly. I heard recently, I talked to Gary Kent, and he's working on a new class, or has developed a new class, I should say, where he's deconstructed the writings of Justice Thomas Cooley. And we've all kind of picked around the edges of Cooley's writings before. It's not a new idea in that respect. But he's going into it in greater detail and greater depth, I believe, than has been done before. And that, you know, sounds really good. I was in a class with Don Wilson not that long ago, and he was studying ancient ways. And that was incredibly eye-opening for me, because it turns out I've got a road about a half a mile from my house that was created by an independent legislative act. It's the Buncombe County Turnpike. And therefore, the rules governing boundaries along that road may well be different depending on the wording of that particular piece of legislation. So, you know, there's definitely no restriction on people getting new classes and new ideas to consider. And I see no reason we have to be, you know, considering continuing education as mere continuing review of what we already know. So, yeah, it's fun to have new ideas out there.
And that's certainly a big point with folks everywhere. I know you and I are going to be seeing Gary in Virginia soon, and finding new topics, and rather than the same stuff over and over and over again, because that really isn't continuing education so much. You know, it's just a review of the same thing. So I agree with you. Trying to find new material is really important. And that you know, that whole turnpike concept is interesting to me. I haven't studied it very much at all in terms of how it was used in different parts of the country or whatever the case may be. I was involved with it some in private practice years ago down in the southwestern part of Virginia, where there were turnpike locations where roads didn't even exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But the underlying ownership never officially reverted back that anybody could see. And I don't know if you've researched that very much or not. I just find that whole thing intriguing, actually.
I've worked around the edges of it, and there's some incredibly important turnpikes. One of the turnpikes I tripped over by accident was the one that was designed to run between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. And that was essentially the authority was created by the legislature, and they created a corporation, which then in turn had the power to take land by eminent domain to create this turnpike. And the, you know, what you're going to find is every state you go into and every turnpike you look at, the rules may well be slightly different depending on the surrounding circumstances at the time, the enabling legislation that led to the construction of the turnpike. What were the needs of the people? How wide did it need to be? How major a road was it going to be? And so, yeah, this is something that's been kind of swept under the rug in times past, I think, and it needs to be brought out from under the rug and looked at. So,
yeah, I think so too. Not only from the perspective of this, the whole continuing education side of things, but just in general, in terms of when people are going through the process of figuring out what they need to know to practice. Because it appeared to me, at least in the work I was doing at that particular time, was you had to really search to find the information, and it wasn't necessarily apparent in the normal chain of title stuff. Chain of deeds, I should say, maybe not title itself.
Well, the chain of title, the chain of deeds, and also, yeah, we're generally not used to going to look at legislative acts, and yet, in cases like this, they create real interests in property. Now, they might be easements, they might be fee simple absolute, depending on the situation, But in a lot of ways, it's very similar to looking at railroads. And I don't mean that in the specifics, but in the general concept that we need to adopt, which is, what was the Enabling Act? What rights did it confer? What rights did the property owners sell to, whether it be the state legislator, the state legislation creating it, or there's a whole lot of things to look at in the way it was created. And I did an article recently, it was on Brandt Living Trust v. USA, and it was in POB a couple of months ago. And in that article, I talked about railroads. But, yeah, the basic approach is the same. How was it created?
Yeah, that's and to me, that's one of those things that, when you talk about continuing education, is a really, really interesting topic, and one that I think would be eye-opening for a lot of people. And as I said in the beginning of the conversation, I'm not really sure how widespread that usage was. I don't know if it occurred everywhere or if it was just in maybe the original colony areas. I don't know. I haven't really researched it very much at all.
No, it was actually pretty widespread. As a matter of fact, that was one of the more eye-opening aspects of Don Wilson's presentation, was he had dug up old maps showing the extent of turnpikes, and they were all over the place, and some of them stretched for 1,000 miles. And so they're something that any surveyor in any state could trip over, the colonial states or the BLM states. It's always a possibility.
Right. And I know in a particular case I was in, there was little evidence at all of where the actual turnpike existed physically. There were a few places where you could, if you looked at it really closely and used your imagination, perhaps you could see maybe a grade cut in out through a pasture field or something. But it was really hard to try to pin down for an actual location.
And in the case like that, one of the things that you might really be looking for, because a lot of those old turnpikes were built with wood, you might dig down and either hit remains of the timbers that they used, if it was, say, a plank road, or you might also find a lot of discoloration in the soil. You might be able to determine the location based on variations in the soil. If you dig a cross-section trench in the vicinity of where you think the roadbed was, you may be able to see it. So the evidence is still there. It just takes more work to get to. And that, you know, both in the field and in the office research, you're talking about just sinking more effort and more time into it than sometimes we'd like to do. But I think it's becoming more and more necessary, because easements are the fight of the 21st century.
Right. And then, of course, just the whole concept of not something that someone would necessarily have run into in their studies or in their path getting up to licensure or whatever stage you're in your career, in terms of how do you make those determinations? It's almost like trying to define wood samples or plants, you know, the kind of things that surveyors don't necessarily do on a regular basis.
Well, and there is this. If you don't know the possibility exists for a problem, then you have no way to know when the danger signs are there and when to look for them. That, to me, has always been one of my major arguments for some of the classes that I teach. You know, I like to do consulting work. I like to sit on the stand and testify in court, and a lot of people feel exactly the opposite. They don't want to be in court and they don't want to testify, but you can end up in court very easily. One of the things I do in class periodically is I'll just ask for a show of hands. You know, how many of you have been in the courtroom testifying on a survey-related issue? And a whole lot of hands go up. And then I say, how many of you were in there on purpose? And most of the hands go back down. So people are getting drug into the courtroom against their will by accident, and quite frankly, that's the worst way to go in, because then usually it means there's a problem and maybe you didn't find it early enough. So learning this stuff is all about staying out of trouble, in my book. Pretty basic.
And not to mention the fact that sometimes you get the call and they want you to come to be a witness on the side that's opposing one of your friends.
Yeah. The conflict of interest.
that's never too much fun to get that call, that's for sure. Well, we got about 3 minutes left in our first segment, but when you brought up turnpikes, I thought it was worth talking about, because one of the things we want to talk about this morning is ways we got ourselves in trouble. And so when you brought that up, I thought, well, this would be a good way to start it out, although you and I didn't really talk about it ahead of time. I just thought it would be interesting to discuss.
No, that's a great new way to get into trouble. I've kind of argued for years, and I'm not the first person to come up with this argument, that surveyors need to study common law. And the question is always, you know, well, I'm a surveyor, I'm not an attorney, why do I need to read case law? And I finally found a Wisconsin ruling that answers that question, to me at least. And it basically says, if there's a law passed by the legislature that's applicable to a situation, the courts will apply it. But if there is no statute, the common law has all the force as if the legislature had, in fact, written the law. So it's really another way of studying what the state's going to require us to do. Just like we as surveyors have to understand the statutes that apply to us, we also have to understand the common law as it applies to the surveying profession. And there's a huge body of that out there, and it's a lot harder to find than the legislation sometimes. So, yeah, there's new ways to get into trouble, and as we become more litigious, it becomes more and more incumbent on us to understand the common law, because that is the standard by which we will be judged when we're in the courtroom. We may not like it, but that's what's going to happen.
Right. And, you know, I think the understanding of that principle, that concept, is one that, of course, speaks to the argument about how one gets prepared to go into licensure. And, you know, there are historic ways we've done it, and there are modern-day times modern ways we do it through more education and those kind of things. But some of these things that we're talking about here would be hard to be presented with in any of those circumstances, because if you're going to university somewhere, you're certainly not going to learn about common law in every state. So, I mean, I guess the point I'm making is it all really falls back on us to really understand what it is our responsibilities are and the circumstances under which we practice and what we're held accountable for. So, I know we only got about 15 seconds left of the break, so I won't go any further. But when we come back, I know there's three other things you and I had talked about in terms of what new ways to get in trouble. So we can pick back up on this a little bit if we need to when we come back, but we'll certainly get into those other areas in the next segment. So let's take a break. We'll be right back.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about Quick Stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that Pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
And here's something new from Schonstedt. Did you know that Schonstedt has upped the ante on trade-ins? Now you can trade in any instrument, theirs or a competitor's, in any condition, working or not, and receive more in trade than ever before. Plus, they'll pay the freight both ways. Contact your local dealer for details or go to Schonstedt.com. That's Schonstedt.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back with Chris Klein in our first segment. Of course, we talked about a number of things. We really talked about surveyors and, and common law. We talked about turnpikes, and we began a discussion about getting ourselves in trouble. And that brings up the thought of accountability and how our board of examiners, our board of licensure, the people who deal with us when we're becoming licensed and perhaps deal with us later on if need be. Maybe we can talk about that side of it as well in terms of what they're intended to do, what they're empowered to do.
Yeah, I found it, maybe I'm a little slow on this. It took me a while to figure this out, to be honest. But the fact that as far as I know, and there may be exceptions to this, but I've never seen a state where the Board of Examiners actually had the power to tell a surveyor to move a corner. And I know it's not, I know they can in North Carolina, I know they can in Virginia and in several other states that I've studied. So the Board of Examiners' role is to regulate the way in which we practice. And of course, it's to protect the public against the surveyors, really, which sounds like an ugly job, and it is to some degree. But the fact that we're licensed in professionals, as professionals, pretty much mandates the fact that we have some sort of oversight to make sure that we protect the public health, safety, and welfare. But in the same breath, the board can't tell us where to put the boundary line. They lack the authority to do so, and the courts pretty much reserve that right to themselves. So we spend a lot of time, and justifiably so, making sure that we practice within the requirements and the regulations that are set by our respective state boards of examiners. And we read about the updates, and we read about the opinions that the boards have released, and we're supposed to do this particular process in this particular way. But we spend a lot less time thinking about the fact that if our boundary survey is challenged and we have fulfilled every tiny detail of the state board standards, that we can still go into court and essentially and lose because we didn't do the job according to the rules that the court set. And that's, again, goes back to my argument before the break. This is why we need to study the common law, because a lot of it is good, solid advice to surveyors that says, if you find this particular situation, this is what the courts say you must do. And those rules apply to attorneys, they apply to judges, they apply to the common citizen, and they apply to surveyors. So the fact that we don't know about them, of course, the old phrase, ignorance is no excuse, and that's very much true. There's plenty of cases out there where they talk about this surveyor came in and he did it wrong, and it was found that his survey was incorrect. The good news is there's case law out there, too, that says, look at what this surveyor did. He did all the research properly, he followed the rules of the court, and therefore we are going to uphold his survey. So that, to me, has at least as much legitimacy, if not more, as making sure we stay within the board mandates that are set by our boards of registration.
So when one is, you use the term studying the common law or understanding the common law, What's the best advice for someone who says, gee, I think I need to do that? I'm not sure there's any prescribed method that anybody's ever laid out. Perhaps there is, but I'm just not aware of it. But how would one go about doing that?
I wish I could lay down a nice definitive method for search, because I'd have to admit that sometimes I've tripped over some really fascinating and sometimes very relevant processes pretty much by accident. But of course, you can take classes. I mean, we've got, Lucas studies the law. We've got Gary Kent. We've got Don Wilson. We all study the case law and all bring it to the attention of the surveyors. But there's also such a thing as Google Scholar. People have asked me, how do you find all this stuff? You can find an amazing amount of case law on Google Scholar, which you can use on your search engine for free. And if you search boundary disputes, if you search monuments, if you search certain terms, then the case law will come up, and you can sit there and you can read the entire opinion for free. So there is that advantage to the age of the Internet. The information is available. several state legislative websites that I've looked at are fairly easy to search in terms of relevant case law, particularly for the more recent stuff. And not always, but certainly the recent case law is relevant because we need to know what changes have occurred. We need to know how the case law has developed. And it definitely does grow and evolve in certain situations as society evolves. Actually, I've just come across a really interesting example of that because I'm researching New Jersey right now for SurfCon, which is coming up in February. And I'm doing a class on riparian boundaries and littoral boundaries. And New Jersey has taken a novel approach to the public trust doctrine, which is, in a nutshell, the protection which is afforded to submerged lands along the coast. And that comes to us from English common law. So New Jersey has taken the somewhat novel step of pushing the public trust doctrine's effect up onto the dry sand areas, whereas originally it was submerged lands only. So, you know, the law does change, and we have to study that. But the recent case law that's out there is available. It just takes some work to dig out.
Well, it's almost mind-boggling to think about the amount of work that can go into to finding these kind of things. And you talked about some of the things you're doing. Maybe this would be a good time to talk a little bit about maybe some of the things you've done recently and where people can find you sometime in the near future.
I've had a fun year. I was in Durango in June. Durango's a beautiful place, and I had a really good bunch of students out there. I did a joint class, actually, because Durango is almost in just on the New Mexico border. So a bunch of New Mexico surveyors were there, and the class was designed both for Colorado and New Mexico surveyors. And this year I'm headed up to, I've got Indiana and Virginia in January, then I'm going up to Maine right at the end of January. I'm going to be at Samoset. That's going to be a fun class. I told them they have to give me an electric blanket as part of my contract. That's not really true, but going to Maine in January, it's going to be a little nippy, I think.
I recall my very first trip that I recall going to a Maine Society conference was at Samoset.
Okay.
And I recall driving up there in probably 45 to 50 degree temperatures and raining. And when I got up the next morning and looked out my window down across the lawn toward either a lake or a river behind it, everything was frozen solid. It had dropped to about zero overnight. And that was a pretty interesting time to be there. So maybe you'll run into that. That'll be fun.
That's what you call fun, is it? Okay.
Yeah, that's very true. Now, you've done some stuff at DECALS, too, haven't you, for District of Columbia?
Yeah, I taught a class for DECALS that was in November, and it was on Gallaudet campus. I got to meet Jim Demma, which was a real privilege. He's quite the legend up there himself. I got
to
meet him. But the DECALS group was a really fun bunch, and I did an adverse possession class there. And Vermont Regional Conference was challenging because I had to teach a seminar that was essentially geared for people in seven different jurisdictions. So that was not just a Vermont conference, and I had to try to bring in research, you know, literally from seven states and also still keep it within my time frames. I could have obviously stretched it out to a week, but that would have been a little bit much. So it was tricky trying to get the relevant information in and then make sure I didn't waste any time so that I could get as much information to the students as I could.
Right. Yeah, I enjoyed the city up there. I thought Burlington was a really neat place.
Oh, wow. It was September. I drove to Vermont. It was beautiful. It was perfect.
And my wife and I actually spent the Saturday after driving through the islands. There's a highway that goes through the islands there, and
mm-hmm.
It was really nice. Oh, I was going to tell you a quick thing about Jim, Jim Demma. He always loves to tell the story about when he was a young child or a teenager, perhaps. He was, I don't know if he was dating this girl or wanted to date her, but her mother referred to him as Jimmy Dilemma.
Well,
he's a fun guy. I don't know how well you know him, but he's a really good guy.
I've talked to him a few times, and like I said, I met him there. He seemed like a very, very pleasant person to hang out with. But I'm glad you told that story and I didn't. Just
he wouldn't mind. He tells it himself all the time. So
okay,
he wouldn't mind at all. Like I said, he's a great guy. So I know we want to get further into some of the things we talked about or just mentioned earlier in terms of new ways to get in trouble. And I know you've given me a little bit of an outline here on three topics you want to talk about. One, slander of title, easements, and the doctrine of merger, and lands protected by public trust doctrine. And we want to get into those. We're approaching our second break. We got about 2.5 minutes left. So I don't know if you want to start with that, or is there something else we've missed in this conversation about the whole concept of common law and what the boards of examination have the power to do or not do?
No, I think I pretty much covered what I was going to in that area. I guess I could say just in 2 minutes that the new class that I've developed for this year, one of them, I should say, which I'm going to be teaching in Virginia, is called Three Not-So-New Ways to Get into Trouble, because they're all deal with concepts which are actually rather ancient, but in fact have kind of been very low profile until recently, and suddenly we're seeing these issues come to the forefront, and they are either surveyors are being charged under these rules, or they're finding that they're dealing with boundary surveys that deal with these issues, and we've not gotten any guidance as to how to deal with them. In particular, slander of title is somewhat tricky for me to talk about in the introduction, because I keep hearing about it from surveyors in casual conversation, and I hear the same thing every time. Well, this thing's in litigation, so I'd appreciate it if you didn't use my name or say where you heard this. And I respect that, and I'm not going to mess anybody up. But I've heard through the grapevine in West Virginia, I've heard through the grapevine in the northeastern United States, that there are surveyors being charged with slander of title, and nobody knows what it is, and there's virtually no case law on it. The most illuminating case I've got, and this is a Virginia ruling that I'm going to use in the class, it's a 2007 ruling, and it says, it appears that the state Supreme Court has yet to fully address the elements of slander of title. I mean, 2007, it's only been in existence for 300 years, and yet the Virginia Supreme Court hasn't addressed it yet.
Now, that's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. Well, when we come back, we will pick up with that topic and then those other two not-so-easy ways to get into trouble in our next segment, and then follow on up with a couple of other things for the rest of the show. So we'll be back shortly.
Getting into underground utility location? If so, you'll want to know about the Schonstadt Instrument Company's MPC kit, a multi-purpose combo for locating both ferrous objects and underground pipes and cables. And because it consists of two instruments in one package, it qualifies for trade-in allowances on two locators. Any kind, any make, any condition. Contact your dealer for details. Or visit www.schonstadt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Schonstedt, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
You're listening to americaswebradio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
As we start our third segment, our regular listeners will recognize this is the time of the show when we do our Parker Davis Quick Stakes contest, and I will ask a question of our guest, and whatever answer the guest provides, the first person to email that answer to quickstakescontest@americaswebradio.com will be the winner of the gift today. So I think the question I want to ask based on our earlier conversation, Chris, is would you quote that the name of the search engine or whatever people need to put into their computer to begin their research for common law and perhaps other things?
Google Scholar was Google, the answer,
Google.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. And maybe you could follow up on that a little bit and just talk about how it works.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that earlier, but it's a fairly easy website. And of course, Google is virtually the first thing that pops up on lots of people's computers nowadays. You go to the Google homepage, and you can click on Google Scholar, and then when you get to the Google Scholar website, you have a choice of searching articles or searching common law. And if you click on searching common law, it gives you the option. You can search all 50 states. You can search a specific state if you want to know what is going on in New Jersey or Massachusetts or wherever. You can search by state. You can search individual words, or you can search phrases. So you can put phrases in quotation marks, and it will look for case law that has that specific phrase. So it's not a perfect search engine, but after all, the price is right. Anybody with access to Google can use it, and there's an amazing amount of stuff there. You generally can't get back to the 1800s rulings and the late 1700s rulings, but a lot of stuff from circa 1950 coming forward to the present day is available. And given the fact that some of the really hot-button issues are discussed in more recent rulings, you can find some good information there.
And maybe you mentioned this, I don't recall, but I assume there at some point you could do that on a selected state basis?
Oh, absolutely. You can search state by state, or you can just say what's going on nationwide and try to search all 50 states and see what happens. You're likely to be flooded with data if you do it that way, which is frequently my problem, but you'll find something.
Yeah, then the challenge becomes how much do you actually get to use, right?
Yeah, and the other trick is making sure that the case law that you're using hasn't been superseded. So sometimes you find an older ruling, and you have to check the more recent ones to make sure that that's still the law in your state. It's a tricky process. The checking backwards and forwards is part of the error checking that I do as I'm designing my classes. When I talk about surface flow, a lot of states have gone from civil law rule to reasonable use rule just in the last 20, 25 years. So you may find old rulings that say common enemy doctrine, but then you find out, oh, that's not true anymore. Matter of fact, New Jersey is one example of that. They've changed their basis for doing surface flow rulings just in the last 20, 25 years.
And I would imagine if one were to be in a situation where you needed to do that research and maybe going into a case or whatever the case may be, these types of things are probably not the types of things your normal, everyday attorney that the landowner would go into town and hire would know off the top of their head, right?
It depends on the attorney. It's like everything else. There's extremely knowledgeable ones, and there's ones who don't know as much about real estate law as we would like. But, of course, that's kind of part of the game. But the flip side is that if you find case law and you're not sure as to its relevance, you know, definitely the thing to do is hand it over to the attorney and ask them, and they can probably shepherdize it and check it that way. So, you know, always these things turn into a collaboration, and I don't intend that my statements and my discussions on the radio show or in my classes, I don't intend these to mean that we don't need to work with attorneys and that we don't need to collaborate with them and that we don't need to respect their expertise and their knowledge base. But it is to me about collecting all the information we possibly can before we walk into that courtroom. And that's, yeah. that's critical.
Now, that makes perfect sense, because as you say, regardless of where we stand on a particular issue, you have to respect everybody who's in the process.
Yeah, absolutely. And the attorneys that I work with, that I really like to work with, a lot of times I bring them case law, and they look at it and they say either, A, you know, this may be helpful, I may be able to use this, or they say, this isn't the way we're going to go with this case, and they put it aside and we don't use it. So ultimately, it's their decision in many respects, but when it comes to where we decide to set the property corners, ultimately it's our decision. It's a collaborative process.
Right. Well, I appreciate you sharing that information on the research part, because I know our audience will find that of interest. And as we were leaving that last segment, you had begun to talk a little bit about the ways to, maybe not so easy ways to get in trouble, but you had mentioned slander of title, and I suppose you wanted to follow up on that.
Yes, slander of title goes all the way back to the English common law, and one of the first cases that I tripped over was actually a South Carolina ruling, and it was a relatively recent ruling, and yet in order to find their authority for slander of title, they actually went back to English common law, because there was no previous precedent that they could find that was appropriate in the South Carolina rulings. So this is something that's coming to the fore. The basic requirements or prerequisites, maybe I should say, for a claim of slander of title is that you have to publish a false statement. It has to be derogatory to the plaintiff's title. It has to be done with malice. It has to cause damages, and it has to result in diminished value to the land. Now, when you think about that, publication of a false statement, what about statements made on a survey plat? Well, a couple of courts have determined that statements made by the surveyor on a map can be the basis of a slander of title charge. The South Carolina ruling was absolutely scary, because the surveyor had signed and sealed a plat showing a disputed strip of land as belonging to his client. And when he was on the stand, he said he had absolutely no data indicating that the disputed strip belonged to his client. In other words, he just mapped it that way because the client told him to. So that was actually, he was found guilty of slander of title, because the statements he made were damaging to the title of the rightful property owner, and he did them with full knowledge that they were baseless. Now, you know, usually this sort of thing is going to be based on mistake, but when you start talking about the requirement for malice, it can be easier to prove malice sometimes than you would think, because sometimes it can just be that you didn't do your due diligence. You didn't do the level of research that would be expected of a surveyor in your area. So malice doesn't necessarily mean conscious intent to do evil. It can be a result of negligence or ignorance. And so, you know, all of a sudden this thing has popped up as the, how shall we call it, the litigation du jour against surveyors. And it's something that we can fall into, because the publication of a document with a false statement could make us subject to a charge.
And when you say a false statement, you're just not talking about some verbiage. You're talking about the statement made by the survey itself, correct?
The fact that the survey represents the boundary line being in a certain location when, in fact, it is not in that location is
right.
Statement.
Right. And that's the point I wanted to make sure got across, was that this doesn't have to be something that's a specific written statement. It's actually the message from the work.
Exactly. And it could, of course, also have to do with something, you know, something to do with the statements, the notes that the surveyor has put on the plat obviously could be a part of that. When we construe a plat, as with any other document, we're going to look at the entire document and say, what does this document do? What does it import about the property? And so any language, any line work on the survey could be possibly, you know, the basis for a slander of title charge if it fulfills all the other requirements, obviously.
So in that that work that you're looking for, you're talking about the class, mm-hmm. does that element, the slander of title, then lead to the other couple of things that we'd mentioned, the easements and doctrine of merger, or how do they pull together, or are they totally separate things?
They are separate issues. The common thread, if you will, that pulls these into a single class is the fact that they're all basically ancient legal principles, which are still enforced today in various forms, and that the lack of knowledge on the part of the surveyor could lead to a problem down the road, or for that matter, pretty much immediately, depending on the circumstance. So that's the thread that ties them together, not that the one necessarily feeds off the other.
I see. Well, I don't know if you want to, we've got 2 or 3 minutes left here before the break, so I don't know if you want to get into either one of those others as a bit, and or we can carry that over to the next segment, too, if we need to.
I'll at least start in on easements and the doctrine of merger. This one is particularly intriguing to me because I'm not the first person to teach these principles, and I'm sure I won't be the last. I've heard Gary Kent speak on the topic. I've heard Don Wilson speak on the topic. You know, it's well known to educators around the country, but what strikes me as interesting is the fact that surveyors get very upset when you bring it up. It's a very disturbing concept, and I'll be teaching a class, and everybody's enjoying the class, and they're learning, and then I bring up this topic, and all of a sudden everybody is not happy. And I think it's because it is scary, and it kind of kicks out one of the underpinnings of something that we feel like we can depend on, which it turns out we can't necessarily. So what I've done this year, instead of teaching the doctrine of merger as a mere side issue, I'm bringing it to the forefront and doing a more in-depth segment to hopefully get through the process more completely and get people on board with it.
Yeah, it's always uncomfortable to think about things we don't want to think about. but as you point out, it's important as part of our education. And after all, if continuing education isn't expanding our education, then it's really not continuing education, is it?
And, you know, there are a whole lot of things in our profession that fall to me in the category of you don't have to like it, you just have to do it. There are obviously things that we would all like to see done differently if the laws were different, if the rules were different. But there are also, because we're professionals, there are things that we just have to cope with because that's the way the law is, and we are... And for the present, we're constrained to follow those rules.
Not our prerogative to just ignore them.
No.
Well, we're right at our third break, so let's go to that, and we'll come back and follow up with the protected trust doctrine, and then I want to talk to you a bit about the war between the states.
Okay.
Schonstedt Instrument Company has been making locating easier since 1953. First, with its yellow stick, the GA52CX, the industry standard for sensitivity. Then, the GA72CD, a shorter and more rugged version offering a magnetic polarity display and a battery and sensitivity indicator. And most recently, the GA92XT, built for portability. It retracts to fit in its holster and extends for one-handed operation and fingertip control. See them all at Schonstedt.com. That's Schonstedt.com.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about Quick Stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
Getting into underground utility location? If so, you'll want to know about the Schonstedt Instrument Company's MPC kit, a multi-purpose combo for locating both ferrous objects and underground pipes and cables. And because it consists of 2 instruments in one package, it qualifies for trade-in allowances on 2 locators. Any kind, any make, any condition. Contact your dealer for details. Or visit www.schonstedt.com. That's Schonstedt.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back for our last segment today with Chris Klein. By the way, thanks for being with me today, Chris. I know we'll get caught up in conversation, so I'll say that now, and maybe I'll get to say it again later. But I really appreciate you being with me. I always enjoy our conversations because one of the things I find so interesting and rewarding about talking to you is you really do good research, and that's interesting for our listeners and also interesting for people who come to the workshops.
I think it's pretty key to gear each class for the state that you're in, because I was an education chairman for a couple of years, and the number one complaint was, well, what does that stuff have to do with us, because that case law is from Wisconsin or Nebraska or somewhere like that. And so, you know, you have to show the big picture, but I also like to really customize the class for the state I'm in. But at the risk of getting ahead of ourselves just a little tiny bit, the wars between the states class I'm going to be teaching in Virginia, that's just a great state to teach that class in for the first time, because you've got the Potomac River on one side of you, and that's been a battleground between Virginia and Maryland for 200 years. So it's a very easy class in that respect to customize, because the case law is there. But before I start making Virginia sound like a bad guy, which is not my intent, virtually all the states, I wouldn't say every one of them, but it seems like virtually all the states in the Union have at one time or another been in a slugfest over one of their state boundaries. Georgia and Tennessee are presently feuding again over access to the Tennessee River and the Georgia-Tennessee boundary. The Georgia-South Carolina border has been litigated a couple of times. North Carolina has been involved in disputes with other states. You go up and down the coast, and everybody's been in a fight over state boundaries. So that one's an easy one to customize state by state.
Just in a general sense, you were talking about the East Coast states. Does it seem to be more prevalent there, or is it that's just your area of study at this point?
Oh, heavens no. Texas has been involved in a few all along the Ohio River. There have been land disputes. Louisiana fought the United States over the offshore extent of jurisdiction for the offshore limits. Western states have fought over river boundaries. The lower Wabash River is a state boundary, if I remember correctly. So, no, this is not any sort of prerogative of the eastern states. There's Iowa versus Nebraska. There was a long-running dispute over that boundary. So, no, it's not a prerogative of the original colonies, that's for sure.
Well, that sort of eases our mind, I suppose, for the ones of us who live here in the eastern part of the country. We're not alone.
No, if we're no worse than the other states, we're no better either. There's a definite a trend all over the place to dispute boundaries. Yeah. A lot of times it has to do with, you know, either tax revenue or some valuable mineral resource. At least a couple of state boundary disputes have been kicked off by the fact that oil was discovered in the substrata under the river. And face it, if the river is, say, 400 feet wide and stretches for 300 miles, that's a lot of oil. Who owns the oil? Who gets the revenue when you pump it out? And what happens when the river boundary moves by accretion and erosion? I mean, that can get pretty mind-boggling, and that's gone to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, perhaps we should talk more about that topic and any specifics you want. I didn't want to get totally away from when we left the last time. We had talked about the slander of title and easements and doctrine of merger, and then I don't think we got into the lands protected by the public trust doctrine.
Well, and quite frankly, the public trust doctrine, if anything, is sort of a bridge topic between the two classes, because a lot of the wars between the states have been fought over the submerged lands along the coast, the river boundaries between the states, of which there are huge numbers of states that have rivers as boundaries. So the public trust doctrine essentially gets into the protections afforded by the state's control of submerged lands that are subject to the ebb and flow of the tide, which of course is, you know, that can affect all the East Coast states, all the Gulf Coast states, California, as well as some of the states that border, say, the Great Lakes. You know, we've got Ohio up on the shore of the Great Lakes, states along the Mississippi River, because the Mississippi is, particularly the lower reaches, is one of those exceptions to the definition of public trust doctrine that restricts it to places where the tide ebbs and flows. The Mississippi is considered to be such a major corridor for transportation that it's almost in a class by itself. So, you know, the public trust doctrine is a segue, if you will, to get us from the first class to the wars between the states, which are frequently fought over water rights.
Yeah, that's so. Do you have some specifics on any of those particular wars? I know that you talked about the Virginia-Maryland one, and then the several others that seem to come up fairly often, not always along water boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's just recently I was reading something about some survey work that had been done, I know, along the North Carolina-South Carolina border. Our buddy Gary Thompson had been involved in that. And then I think more recently maybe something on the Virginia-North Carolina border. I think I heard something about that. But so I guess the point is, after all this time, one would think all those kinds of things are pretty settled, maybe more particularly where they don't have to do with water, which tends to move things around a little bit. But still, that whole idea of the where those boundaries really lie, I mean, I would think most people would think, gee, isn't that settled a long time ago?
You'd like to think so, and your mention of the survey between the South Carolina and North Carolina border, you know, brings up a good point. Now, that one didn't get litigated. The good news is the relevant state legislatures acted in a responsible manner, and they essentially created a joint commission to retrace the original boundary. And I know a couple surveyors who have been involved in that, and they're having fun out there finding the original stones that were set by the original survey party. On the one hand, yes, the boundary is where it is. And on the other hand, we've got a lot of people along the borders who owned property that, because they had relied on the GIS or the local databases in the past, had assumed that their property was in South Carolina, and it turns out it was in North Carolina, or vice versa, or their house has been split in half by the resurvey of the state line. And that affects people in a lot of ways, because suddenly we have to figure out, how do we get our public service gas if we're suddenly in the wrong state? Where do we pay our power bill? Where do our kids go to school? How do we pay property taxes? And it also brings up the specter of acquiescence between sovereign states, which is one of the issues that I talk about in the wars between the states. Acquiescence originated as essentially a title doctrine in New York between private individuals, but it has been adopted and developed by the U.S. Supreme Court over the last almost 200 years, and is applied, I wouldn't say routinely, but it is applied at times to state boundaries. So we've got that trick. We can survey the original location, but if they decide to litigate this thing and take it to the U.S. Supreme Court, is the court going to find that the states, by their acts of acquiescence over a long period of time, have created a new state boundary line? You know, and that's a separate issue from dealing with acquiescence between private individuals. I've emphasized that point. But that's one of the things that happens frequently. It comes up a lot. I've got a really good string of U.S. Supreme Court rulings that talk about acquiescence between states. And that's a very real possibility. Actually, and my favorite topic, adverse possession, comes up. Prescription can, at times, be brought into play to resolve state boundary lines, and for that matter, even international boundaries. So there are other mechanisms at work just besides the riparian boundary issues of the river. By the way, kind of carrying on here with your earlier comment, you said you thought a lot of this stuff had been resolved. Virginia and Maryland were at the U.S. Supreme Court again in 2003 because they were litigating the extent to which Virginia had the right to draw water from the Potomac River. And it had to do with the fact that Virginia was building a structure which would extend out into the river to put the water intake away from the shore. So that was a bitterly fought case, and that's one of the ones I use in class because it basically goes through the entire history of the litigation over the Potomac River and exactly what rights were adjudicated to each state. And so, yeah, the fights are not over. They're still going on.
Yeah, you were talking about the North Carolina-South Carolina border. Sometime relatively soon, I'm going to have Gary Thompson and Sid Miller on. Gary, of course, from North Carolina, Sid from South Carolina. That really are two of the primary players in that commission you were talking about.
And, yeah, that would be great.
So they're not talking too much about rivers necessarily, but I think there is a pretty big issue about some guy, whether he can sell liquor or not because he's in the wrong state now or something. But, you know, you run into those kind of things all the time when these things come up. And by the way, we only got a couple minutes left here, but I don't know if you – do you know who Bill Morton is?
Does not ring a bell with me.
Bill is he's a real Ellicott fan, and he just contacted me recently. He's writing or has written a new book about Ellicott's – it's called The Untold Story of America's Boundary Line with Spain and his mm-hmm. work in doing that. So I've been reading a synopsis. I think it's going to be a really cool book and will certainly fall on, in this case, international boundaries, I suppose, and then ultimately some state boundaries that came as a result of that. So clearly these issues in defining boundaries between states or countries, for that matter, play a big role in what we're doing. So it sounds to me like this course you're coming up with or have come up with will be a really interesting one for people to hear about.
I think it's interesting both from a historical perspective and also from a practical perspective. The ruling I was just talking about, the most recent slugfest between Virginia and Maryland, discusses the effect of the state boundaries on private property ownership along the river. So,
absolutely.
You know, some of this is of a more historical interest, but some of it is of immediate interest to any surveyor who's going to survey along the Potomac River, which
right.
stretches for several hundred miles.
And as always, our time goes way too fast. We're 30 seconds away from expiring our time today. So before you go, I want to thank you for being with me. It's always great to have you on the show, and I will look forward to seeing you at the Virginia Conference because I'll be getting some credits while we're there.
Absolutely. I'll see you there.
Yeah, and thanks for joining me, even though remotely today. And I appreciate that. It's very kind of you to be on the show. So I will look forward to seeing you soon, and thanks again for being with me today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Bye-bye.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.